1 Timothy chapter 6, as we continue our study in the book of 1 Timothy. Let as many servants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, that the name of God and His doctrine be not blasphemed. I don't know about you, does your heart just stop when the Bible starts talking about servants and masters? And we know that that word servants is the word doulos, and it is a bond slave, not a servant like you would think of as a butler necessarily, although you might be surprised to find out it's more like that than what I used to think. I've been telling you for some time we're going to talk about slavery. I really was waiting until we were going to get to Exodus chapter 21. But when you read a passage like this, and you realize it's talking about slaves and it's talking about masters, how can the Bible justify something like slavery? Why doesn't it denounce it? Why doesn't it say, listen, this is something that that is an abhorrence and should not be really done, let alone give instructions to servants or slaves and masters? I mean, when we read a verse like this, sometimes our senses are shocked, and you know, if we're Bible-believing Christians, we are almost distraught that the Bible would even mention slavery. And I'll tell you, the people that hate God and would love to tear down everything that the Bible stands for will point at this as an issue, especially in our day and age, to say that is why you shouldn't listen to the Bible. It's a book of oppression. Well, let me tell you, biblical slavery was anything but. And so tonight, I'm not going to exegete this passage, and we'll get back to it, Lord willing, but I want to spend some time discussing biblical slavery. And so, like I said, I was going to wait until we got to Exodus chapter 21, but I believe there's enough in that chapter that we'll be able to revisit and really not overlap a lot of information. We'll talk about some of the same things. It'll be several weeks or months from now, so it'll be a good reminder. But I want you to understand that, first of all, the Bible never defends the practice of slavery. It just assumes that there's going to be some kind of subjugation that is in effect. Oftentimes when we read a verse like 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 1, we think, and as pastors, we automatically jump. We say, well, we don't have that anymore. And so we jump to the employer-employee relationship. And I'll tell you, I believe it is more like that relationship in biblical days than it ever was to the old Southern slavery that we as Americans often think of when we think of slavery. We'll see that much more clearly when we get to Exodus chapter 21. Slavery transforms, it ought to transform our thinking, because the practice was carefully regulated between the relationship of the master and the slave in ways that would eliminate abuse. Now, notice what I said. I didn't say it was given to mitigate abuse. The laws that God gave to govern biblical slavery were to completely eliminate abuse. Now, we'll talk about this at the end of the message, but I want you to understand this, that whenever mankind is given power, the depravity of man will automatically cause that power to be used for self-interest. All right? That is the old man. That is the old nature. And you can see that in leadership of countries where there's a despot. There's an old saying that power corrupts, and ultimate power corrupts ultimately, right? We understand that. That's the old nature. But God was giving the law that would prevent that from happening. For us as Americans, it's hard for us to understand biblical slavery. We have had so much of America's slavery really just left an indelible mark on our minds that we struggle with the biblical teaching about masters and slaves. Our painful national experience with slavery makes it hard, if not almost impossible, to appreciate the very different in social and economic circumstances of biblical slavery. I mean, when you hear the word slavery, most Americans immediately think Civil War and everything that led up to it. But there are critical and important differences between the slavery found in the antebellum South and slavery in ancient Israel in Bible days. Primarily, the biggest difference was slavery in ancient Israel was voluntary, at least for the Israelites. And we'll cover some of the other ways that people became slaves in that day. But what would happen is people would often hire themselves into the service of another. Oftentimes, this was because they were completely destitute. They had no money. Maybe they mismanaged their money. Perhaps they were in debt and they needed to make a living. And we'll cover some of these different things in just a moment. But I want you to understand the only way that they could meet their needs while at the same time paying off this debt or getting back on their feet was to sell themselves as an indentured servant or a slave to someone who could afford that kind of help. And so really, servant is a good understanding for that arrangement. They were not slaves like what we would think of the term, but something more like an apprentice, maybe a hired hands or even an indentured laborer. I don't want to say I agree with Colin Kaepernick, but I will say this. You could think of an NFL star or an NBA player that agrees to an $87 million two-year contract or two-year extension if your name is LeBron James as an indentured player, right? They have contracted themselves for a certain amount of money for a certain amount of time. That's exactly what was happening for the most part in ancient Israel. A fellow would come and say, I need a job, and I'll indenture myself for 2 years, 5 years, to be able to pay off whatever debts I may have. You know, I don't begrudge anyone that can make that kind of money playing a children's game. If you can get paid to do it and it's not illegal or immoral and God's called you to do that, then that's fine. I'm not about, you know, socialism or communism. I think it's ridiculous, all right? When you have doctors that are paid well, but in comparison to people that are playing games. By the way, I don't want to get too far on a tangent, but let me tell you, someone that plays a game or lies in front of a camera by pretending to be somebody that they're not has no more information about social events than you do. And a matter of fact, if you have your Bible, you are much more prepared to gauge what is going on rather than listening to some Hollywood star or starlet or some sports player talk about whatever is happening. I don't understand why those people get a platform to be able to speak when a lot of times they have no understanding biblically of what is going on in the world. Please don't go home thinking about that and only that, okay? But you can think about it. So what would happen to the indentured servant? Well, he'd live in his master's home, and he would work hard in exchange for room, board, and of course, he would still get a stipend or an honest wage as the years rolled on. By the way, I want to remind you this. Not only was involuntary slavery forbidden, it was condemned and it was punishable by death. You write this down in the margin of your Bible next to there in 1 Timothy chapter 6 if you want, but it's Exodus 21:16. As God is giving the law, he says, and he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall be surely put to death. This law completely eliminates the whole institution of slavery as it was practiced in Africa, in Brazil, and in the entire West. And it is still practiced, by the way, in some parts of the world today. But the Bible strictly forbids man-stealing. Whenever people try to accuse God in the Bible of being for the Old South or old Southern slavery, this is something they completely overlook. But the Bible passage dealing with masters and servants have little or nothing to do with slavery in America, because that form of slave trading was a flagrant violation of the law of God. And by the way, conversely, any preacher that tries to justify the antebellum slavery would be unbiblical and ungodly. The problem is that old Southern slave trade is still generating conflict in our nation today. And it is the thing that we as Christians ought to condemn, even as the Bible condemns it. It's a blight on our national history, but it was not the same as the slavery discussed in your Bible. If you were to have or be a slave, Old Testament or even a New Testament servant or doulos would manage your household, possibly. He might be your bookkeeper. He would control your inventory. He was the one who decided how to use your resources. You think about Joseph. Now, I understand he was bought into slavery, but you understand he was well taken care of in Potiphar's house. He was given the clothes that he needed. He was given the food that he needed. He was given a great place to live. And he had everything, he said, under his master's control except for his master's wife. Do you understand that as a slave, that's not our Western concept of slavery. We can see illustrations of that all through the New Testament as well. The would-be slave is the one who contracted to come to serve in exchange for his long-term submission to this master. He would get his housing, his clothing, his food, and even money for living expenses and his personal things. They were allowed to own things. They were allowed to buy things. They were allowed to have things. So there were different ways that people would become slaves in Bible days. Well, before I get into those, let me just mention this. There were some people who loved being in that family so much. I just don't have enough time to go over everything. I know if I touch on everything I want to talk about, we'd be here till about 9 o'clock. But it is so amazing that when you see Jesus wash somebody's feet, you understand the absolute lowness. The Jews, although they were slaves, still were not forced to wash people's feet. The Gentiles would have to do that, Gentile slaves, because it was the lowliest of lowlies. And so that's just an aside. But there were people that would come in and just like learning a trade, and they would almost, it's not adopted, but they would come into this family and they would work for this family. The slave would be really the equal to the oldest son. You think of Abraham and Eliezer, I'm not pronouncing his name right, but I think it was Eliezer, the servant of Abraham. He was going to get everything if Abraham did not have a proper son to be able to, or a proper heir to be able to pass it down to. My greatest desire for you tonight is not just to understand more about biblical slavery, but for you to divorce your thinking from Western and Civil War slavery, to understand they are completely different things. So I'm going to keep hammering on that over and over again because I want you to see the differences. So they were under contract most of the time. There were two lengths of time that were the maximum amount of time that somebody could be entered into slavery. For a non-Jew, a Gentile, the longest somebody could contract themselves into slavery was 50 years. 50 years. And every 50 years, there was something called the Year of Jubilee. And everybody that was an indentured slave would be set free. For a Jew, by the way, you can find that in Leviticus 25:10. I don't have time to go into that at all. But for a Jew, it was only 6 years. You can see that in Exodus 21:2, Deuteronomy 15:12. And so for a Jew to contract, to live for someone else, they could get their trade. Now, could they re-up? I believe they could, but there'd have to be another package. There'd have to be another deal. There'd be another payout, if you will. And so, obviously, God had made a way for slaves that could stay in that family. They could put their ear against the doorpost and put an awl through and put some sort of earring in there, but it was proclaiming that he wanted to stay, and it was a sign of submission to his master. But 50 years would be the absolute longest for a Gentile, but 6 years was the absolute longest for a Jew to be in subjection to another Jew. It could be negotiated for shorter than that, but those were the max limits. And I think that's God's way of protecting the Jews against owners that might be trying to take advantage of them. You have I signed up for 4 years when I first joined the Navy, and I extended for 2 years. There was an obligation that I had, and I found out I didn't like being away from my wife for 8 months, 9 months out of the year, and so I decided I'm not going to do that again, right? It was something I didn't, I learned a lot, I got a trade from it, but then it was time for me to move on. Could I have re-upped? Yes, absolutely. They would have paid me, at that time, it seemed handsomely, to be able to continue, but it wasn't worth it. So I just want you to understand that almost like conscripting into the military, it was an agreement on both sides. So how did people become slaves in those ancient times? I believe they were acquired in several different ways. One of the ways was through capture or through conquest. In fact, the people of Israel knew what it was to be servants to other conquering nations. They were servants to the Phoenicians, the Philistines, the Syrians, the Babylonians, even the Romans. And there were other nations who, in being conquered by Israel, were servants to them as well. I've read, not at great length, but I've read that it was thought to be a very humanitarian option to conquer a people and then make them servants. Why is that? That's what the Babylonians did with Daniel and the three Jewish boys. Daniel was a slave, a servant. He rose to become the prime minister of the whole Babylonian Empire as a slave. Now, because we have wrong thinking, because we have this Western thinking of slavery, we say, how can a plantation slave ever become the prime minister? Do you understand? Just because we're using the same word, you need to completely eliminate the definitions you have and get a biblical definition of biblical slavery. So rather than killing the enemy that you conquered, you'd keep them and put them in a role of serving you. There's at least three different places that you can see that in the Bible. Numbers chapter 31, Deuteronomy 20, 2 Chronicles chapter 28. All of those show how a conquered people are brought in to serve the conquerors, and showing that they were treated well, and it was the really in the best interest of those being conquered as well. In effect, when you come in, the economy of that nation is completely destroyed. You understand that? I know we don't think in ways of economies. Most of the warfare that we have in the world today is not with physical weapons. I'm talking about nation to nation. I'm not talking about Christians. We know it's spiritual warfare for Christians, but it's usually economic warfare. China is constantly falsely setting their currency below what it is, so it affects the trade rates. It's really an economic war that we're constantly fighting with other nations. So when another nation comes in, what happens? There is complete and utter unemployment. Right? The businesses are gone. There's going to be high taxation. So what happens is this conquering nation comes in and they take these people and they turn them into, in essence, employees. And now you have production. You have forward progress. You have people that are working and getting paid for that. So now that doesn't mean always that was 6 years for those countries that are coming in and conquering. But certainly for 50 years, after 50 years, they had to be released if they're still alive. And so the first way that people became servants was through becoming a captive in war. Secondly, people were brought into slavery through, as I've already mentioned a couple different times, through a contractual agreement. You could be a foreigner and say just somebody coming in from another country, and you move into Israel and you're looking for a job. You can't find anything. You're destitute. But a landowner could say, listen, I can use your service. And then that person would contractually agree to work for that person rather than just seasonally. He would say, I'll work for you for X amount of time. Now, oftentimes, but this is not always true, oftentimes the agreed amount that person was going to be paid was paid up front. And then they would work off the debt that they were already given. So they could make payments to pay themselves off earlier. Oftentimes they could redeem themselves, or someone from the family could come and say, well, listen, we need your help over here, and so we're going to redeem you from this guy, but now you can come and work for us. So you could sell yourselves to other members of the Jewish community. And by the way, once you became a servant or a slave, then you could be sold from that person to another person if that person needed their investment back, or they just didn't think you were a great worker, whatever it might be. So those people that were given their money up front, if they were spendthrifts, if they did not know how to handle their finances, and they would be completely bankrupt by the time that their service was ended, they could put themselves right back into bondage again in that sense. Now we see that today, right? Somebody gets a credit card, they put themselves in great bondage, they think they get it paid off, and what do? They go out and do it again. When we get to Leviticus chapter 21, you're going to find out some of the laws that you thought are horrible are really a protection for the people that were in slavery, especially the wives and the children. And we'll get to that, but not tonight, all right? But it is amazing. As I've studied this, I've realized how gracious God is to protect those people. I mean, you start thinking about how is it that a man would be set free, but his wife and children would stay with the master? Stay tuned for 3 months or 4 months, and we'll get to that. Why would God do that, all right? I'm leaving you on a cliffhanger on that one. Or you can come talk to me, and I'll tell you the answer, all right? But slavery always had a redemptive purpose. Its goal was not perpetual bondage, but it was responsible independence. The Hebrew servant was ultimately bound for freedom. So not only could you sell yourself, you might sell your family. In Exodus 21:7 and Nehemiah 5, a father sold his daughter to work in a home. It wasn't a bad thing or an evil thing to do. Excuse me, Nehemiah 5 was the father and his daughter. But you would literally contract with someone to employ your daughter to work in the house and do something like that. And then guess what would happen? The master of the house would observe this young lady working in his house. If she was diligent, if she was a hard worker, then he would say, listen, why don't you marry my son? So you see, it wasn't something that this is horrible. This father is selling his daughter into slavery. What he's doing is saying, listen, this is an opportunity for her to have security. This is an opportunity for her to have protection. And it might be that if she's a hard worker, she could be married into this family. It was a way for a father really to look out for his daughter in a way maybe he couldn't financially otherwise. And so really it was a good thing for both families. A widow, according to 2 Kings 4:1, could sell her children into the employment of someone to pay off her husband's debts, who could no longer do that because, well, he is dead. They didn't have bankruptcy protection in that day. There wasn't the social safety nets that we think of here in America. If you owed money for years and years, even in the West, you could get thrown into debtor's prison. Also in Nehemiah 5, in the first part of the chapter, some families had used their children as collateral for a loan, and when they defaulted on a loan, they put their children into the service in order to pay back what they had borrowed. So this idea of if I can just put it this way, self-sale of entering into the contractual agreement to go work for somebody was not uncommon. So you could be conquered, or you could contractually agree to go work for somebody, and people would employ themselves who were willing to be bought, and there would be people whom one owner would sell to another, as I mentioned. The other way, and I've mentioned this a couple different times, but it was through debt. If you incurred debt that you couldn't pay back, you might go work for somebody to pay off this debt, and you became a slave until that debt was eliminated. Take for granted, if somebody had stole something, a thief could not pay what he had taken and was placed into slavery to the one he had robbed, or perhaps he would be sent to work for someone who could afford a salary for him, and he would have to give back more than what he had taken, according to God's word. Some were not just bought, but they were given as gifts. You can go back to Genesis and see Leah received her slave Zilpha as a gift, or Zilpah, excuse me. Sometimes they were passed down from generation to generation. I will tell you that in the New Testament times, there were more slaves, if you call them that, than there were citizens. I think I read somewhere that there was about 600,000 people in a certain part of Rome, or I'm sorry, 800,000 people, and of that, 500,000 were indentured slaves. It was basically an employer and employee relationship, and you have to have that for society to function. The biblical form of slavery had a constructive purpose. There's never a statement in the New Testament or the Old Testament telling masters to let their slaves go. There's never a statement telling slaves to seek their freedom. Onesimus had to go back. Why? He had an obligation. In the Old Testament, we're never told to abolish slavery because it's not the slavery that our culture thinks of. Ordinarily, slavery is for the master's advantage. He gets his work done at his slave's expense. By the way, that is a terrible economy. I read a book on George Washington last year, and I will tell you, he was fighting against the economics of slavery long before he died. When he died, he set all of his slaves free. That was kind of a cowardly thing to do. But he realized he could not get the work out of people who were being forced to labor like you could when you paid somebody to labor. He couldn't see how to make the financial transition in his life, and so he set them free after his death. But he understood long before he died that economically, slavery, the kind of slavery, the antebellum slavery, is untenable long-term economically. But the purpose of slavery in the Bible, in Israel, was to train men and women to become productive members of society. And so whether they became a servant because they were in debt, sometimes through their own negligence, and sometimes through to make restitution for something they've taken or stolen, was a result of their poor choices, but God had given them away. That, in a sense, was the social safety net of that day. By the way, I think this mode of slavery is better than just handing somebody money for staying home and not working at all. Slavery was God's way of training irresponsible men to manage their own affairs. Were there abuses? Yes. But I don't think that was the norm. I think that was the exception. I think there must have been because of the sinful nature of mankind. But the slaves in the Roman Empire were, for the most part, better off than their free counterparts. I found this in an article, and it's from a book by Tenney Frank, T-E-N-N-E-Y, and he wrote something called Economic Survey of Ancient Rome. He said the free man who just sold himself to whoever to do whatever work could be done was paid one denarius a day. And we've heard that from different parables in the New Testament. So one denarius a day. Compare that, say, with the soldiers of Julius Caesar. Archaeological records say that they were paid 225 denarii a year, which would be less than one a day, but they were given all their food, all their shelter, and all their plunder, and Caesar Augustus gave them 3,000 denarii bonus on the 20th year of their service. Once again, if they lived that long to collect it. One of Caesar's scribes received one denarius a day, so just a day laborer, a soldier, would be around one denarius a day. Diocletian set the wages at one half to one denarius. So if you look at that and you assume that a free man worked about 6 days a week, at one denarius a day, he's going to get 330 denarii a year. A 184 of that would go to his food. They figured all that out. 5 to 10 of it would go for clothing, but that would be nothing fancy. That's just the very basic minimum. And that adds up to about 279 and leaves about 35 denarii left for everything else for a full year. I know that's a lot of numbers, but I want you to compare that with a slave. He received all of his food. By the way, if somebody could afford to have a slave like this, he was probably getting fed fairly well. He had a place to sleep, usually on the second floor, which would have been a place of privilege. And the house would have been employed not just with them, but other domestic servants that would have been being fed and clothed as well. But the best of clothing, the best place to stay, and it's estimated that most of the slaves of ancient times stayed, as I said, on the top floor of the house, inside the house, and they would have received their housing, their clothing, plus 60 denarii a year spending money, which is double what the other man who is free would have had indeed if he had worked every day for a year. So all I'm saying is it was to the advantage of the man that could find somebody that would be willing to take him on or take him in, and he'd be able to provide what was needed for him to survive would be provided for him. Whereas a day laborer would have to feed himself and his family on those same wages. So I hope that you can see that God had given this as an institution to help, to train, to protect, to further economically the country that had this system of slavery. So now when you go to the New Testament or the Old Testament, I hope that it changes your thinking completely when you see that word slavery, when you see that word master or slave. It was a system that worked in that time. So when you think of biblical slavery, don't think of half naked people that are in just rags and chains clasped to their ankles. Don't think of people who are being whipped in the back or smacked with staffs or working 7 days a week for 16 hours. Listen, that might be what Western slavery was, and what a horror, and as I mentioned, a blight on our national history. But that's not what biblical slavery is. It was more of a journeyman's apprenticeship or a learning trade or performing menial tasks simply to get out of debt. I want you to think of people who were treated graciously, who were part of a family, who contracted to offer their skills and their services for a set amount of time. And while there might have been abusive situations, I don't believe that to be the norm. Taking advantage of others is part of our sinful nature. And whenever mankind has power, as I said earlier, we tend to abuse it. But God wanted his people to take care of one another. And so for that reason, he regulates this relationship so it would be mutually beneficial, voluntary temporary and beneficial for both the master and the slave. Not what we normally think of when we think of slavery. So then when you see in chapter 6, verse 1, let as many servants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor. I hope that you understand that that person that is working under that other person is not looking them at as an owner in the sense that that person is just property. But he's looking at them thinking, this is someone that I can train and I can teach. And the other person is to look at that person, training them, teaching them, helping them with all honor. We'll go over those verses more, but I wanted you to have right and good thinking about biblical slavery. In no way, let me make it very clear, would I ever sanction or approve of the antebellum slavery that this country has gone through. I just want to make that very clear. But we need to understand what God has said about biblical slavery and understand that it was a help and not a hindrance to those that were a part of it.